Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is supported by the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre at the University of Sydney. SEAC is a university-wide multidisciplinary initiative that facilitates collaborations and builds on the expertise of our researchers to address the region's challenges. If you'd like to know more about SEAC's latest activities, click on the links included on the New Books in Southeast Asian Studies website. If you'd like to listen to more podcasts about Southeast Asia, check out the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre's podcast series, SEAC Stories, available on the New Books in Southeast Asian Studies website.
Another great sponsor of New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is the Griffith Asia Institute, an internationally renowned research centre committed to the study of and engagement with Asia and the Pacific. The Institute's research focuses on politics, security, and economic development, emphasising the enhancement of links between businesses, governments, and academia. For more information on Griffith Asia Institute's activities, click on their website link on the New Books in Southeast Asian Studies website. Hello and welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Faiza Zakaria from Nanyang Technological University and your host for today. It is such a pleasure to have with me today Farah Bifake, the author of Authoritarian Modernization in Indonesia's Early Independence Period, The Foundation of the New Order State, 1950 to 1965, published by Brill in 2020. Dr. Farabi is lecturer at the History Department at Gajah Mada University in Yogyakarta, Indonesia, and he's the head of the graduate program there. He received his PhD from Leiden in 2014 and is an expert on Indonesian urban history, the political economic history of the Indonesian state, and Indonesian business history. Abi, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, welcome, Faiza.
Thank you so much for being here. Let me first give a quick overview of your fascinating book before we begin. Authoritarian Modernization in Indonesia's Early Independence Period offers a historical analysis of the foundational years leading to Indonesia's New Order State. During the early independence period, the study looks into the structural and ideological state formation during the so-called liberal democracy and Sukarno's guided democracy period running from 1950 to 1965 in total. In particular, it analyzes how an international technical aid network and the dominant managerialist ideology of the period legitimize a new managerial elite. This book discusses the development of education in the civil and military sectors in Indonesia, and from a solid basis of empirical sources, it argues that Sukarno's constitutional reform during the guided democracy inadvertently provided a strong technocratic blueprint for the new order development. So I found this book very timely since there has been a resurgent global interest in the origins and formation of authoritarian regimes as many states around the world drift away from liberal democracy. Indonesia's experiences with such an authoritarian turn in the 1950s and 1960s offers many lessons from history, and I'm excited to learn about them from Dr. Farabi. So let's start with the time period of the book, and that's Sukarno's guided democracy period, as well as the liberal democracy period. So you term the Dieter democracy period as a revolution and showed how it set the template for the emergence of the authoritarian new order. So for listeners who might not be familiar with Indonesia, can you tell us more about this period of history? Who are the main players and why is it so interesting and significant in Indonesian history?
Yeah, thank you, Faiza, for the question. So the guided democracy period is a period between 1957 until 1966. Usually people refer to those years. And it's a series in which a series of institutional reforms were initiated by President Sukarno and the army that really ended Indonesia's first experiment with liberal democracy since 1950 until 1957. So some people point the start at the issuance of the presidential decree by Sukarno in 1959, but others, including me, I look at it as starting since the end of the second Ali Sastro Mijoyo cabinet and the series of anti-corruption measures implemented by the army. What it did was that it arranged in Indonesian state and society in accordance to Sukarno's vision of revolution guided by the Republican leadership and planned and managed by the Indonesian population with the help of experts. Thus, there are three elements that make up guided democracy revolution. The first are the expert class, the managerial class, which my book focuses on. The managerial class are composed of civilian and military public administrators and business managers. The second are the political class, in particular the communists, but also various political leadership of groups in society, both party or societal groups. And the third is, of course, Sukarno himself, who tried to manage this seemingly opposing elite class of managers and experts on one side and political class on the other side. So this period is interesting because while the guided democracy revolution is seen to end in a spectacular hail of violence with the collapse of Sukarno's government and the decimation of Indonesia's communists, the period, in my opinion, is essential in understanding the structural foundation of the new order.
Definitely. And is that the reason why you became interested in this topic? And how did you find a fresh angle to this period?
Well, you know, I had conducted my bachelor's research on Sukarno's nation-building project in Jakarta, how he symbolically built up the city as the capital of the nation. So I've always had a fondness for the 1950s and 1960s because of its generational potential in Indonesian history. The period was always rather opaque in the eyes of many Indonesian historians, although more interests have come to light nowadays. The reason for the opaqueness has been the hegemonic narrative developed by the New Order, which defined the period as one of chaos with societal and economic breakdown. This narrative was developed in a way to absolve the new order from the Sukarnian project. By putting distance from Sukarno, the new order made its case for legitimacy exactly through that contrast. Instead, I want to put back guided democracy as a central and foundational feature in understanding the new order. Sukarno's guided democracy is central in understanding this period. It is the foundational years that determine the kinds of nation-state and state-society relations that Indonesia would adhere to for the rest of the 20th century. The start of the developmental state is thus, I would argue, didn't come from the rise of the new order, but from the tentative and increasingly assertive position of experts within the guided democracy state. So the enmeshing of civilian and military managers also occurred during this period. So this coalescing of managerial elite, which allowed, you know, the new order developmental state to rise. So, because, you know, what really started my question, what animated my research was, how is it possible that such a weak and chaotic guided democracy state suddenly transformed into a strong developmental state of the new order? That was what guided my research.
And I think it is very interesting that you are intervening on this sort of idea of 1950s as chaos and 1965 onwards as a kind of new order, so to speak. So how do we connect then the 1950s back to sort of revolution and the sort of more conventional ways in which we define revolution in Indonesia, for example, decolonization against the Dutch in 1945 or social revolution in 1948? Do these revolutions sort of feed into each other? Do they flow into each other? And how did the guided democracy revolution become connected with these other concepts of revolution?
Right. Very interesting question, Faiza. Well, you know, my focus on the 50s was in reading the discourses and the narratives produced by Indonesian elite. And when I read like Sukarno's speeches and the main documents of the regime, it helps a lot in deciphering what he meant by revolution. There is a tendency to look at Sukarno as an ideologue whose speeches carry more, you know, the spirit and political conviction instead of a blueprint for future Indonesian society. He was seen as an orator whose words moved the hearts and minds of millions of Indonesians. And by his critics, he was also criticized as a demagogue who incites fear and hatred. Yet, you know, underneath his bravado and fiery theatrical perlocution is sort of a program for the future of Indonesia. His revolution is developmentalist in nature. And in a way, if you look at his speeches during the Indonesian Revolution, the Independence Revolution of 1945 until 1950, it very much is replicating this kind of spirit of which are developmentalist in nature. It is based on a reconfiguration of a managerial state. So this revolution, which Sukarno pushed forth in the end of the 50s, was very much sort of thinking along the lines of creating a managerial state with national planning, with industrialization and economic growth, yet combining this managerial approach with a sweeping political program to move people and the political leadership under a state-guided development regime. His revolution was to ensure that the political position of the people through the political leadership class was to have a guiding seat in a new managerial-based developmental state. So in this, he probably saw that the political class, the leadership that had obtained an education within the nationalist movement, was slowly to lose their role in the newly educated technical class, managers and experts. So there's this transition between the old leadership and the new leadership of managers and experts. And Sukarno's revolution can be seen as a means to preempt this through the creation and integration of experts and politicians within a guided democracy state. Now, although this aspect failed, his revolution really paved the way for a reordering of the Indonesian state in which experts gained the upper hand, in particular sites within a highly centralized state. So in terms of looking at how the revolution of 1945-1946 affected Sukarno's ideas of revolution later in the end of the 50s, there's very much a strong correlation in a sense that he wants to place political class within a developmentalist state model, which has always been the case, even during the period of wartime of the 40s.
So we've talked about the guided democracy revolution and its link to various concepts of revolution. And the main argument in your book is that the development of a new managerial class during the 1950s and the 1960s resulted in the creation of both the ideological and institutional basis for a military-dominated managerial state. Can you tell us a bit more about these developments and whether they were specific to Indonesia or representative of the colonizing nation states as a whole?
Well, you know, what I meant by the managerial class here really do not so much as to denote their particular efficacious nature. So it's not really about whether they're like efficient managers or not. It's really more of a denotation of a particular new identity of state elite that had appeared in the 1950s. And Indonesia, in this case, is not unique. The rise of a managerial ideology was something that had occurred globally. This was something that had its roots in the rise of public administration and management science since the late 19th century. But the retooling of whole economies during the total wars of World War II had provided an impetus for America to model its modernization theory on. So America had a major role in sort of exporting this managerial ideology. And this ideology was something really to counter the state-led developmentalism that was propped up by the Soviet Union, by China and others, by communist states. So as you can see, both the East and the West within this Cold War dynamic opted to support a kind of state-led model of development. In a sense, as one famous American social scientist noted, ideology in the 1950s had really died. In particular, the ideology of liberalism had taken a backseat to the ideology of managerialism and the centrality of the state. In this regard, it is important to define Indonesian developmental ideology and the institutional reforms that were implemented prior to and during the guided democracy within this managerialist ideology that was really global in nature at the time. The Cold War divide between capitalism and communism didn't matter much anymore because there was an agreement to the weaknesses of liberal democracy to achieve development. Instead, the period was grounded in an agreement on the need to achieve a managerial state, or at least a developmental state, thus the managerial ideology and the necessary institutional reforms to make this happen. This is where my focus lies in analyzing Sukarno's revolution. We often forget the supremacy of this ideology today because of the shift back towards liberalism in the 1970s and upwards and the proclamation of the end of history with a liberal victory by the early 90s. So the shift back to neoliberalism at the end of the 20th century. Yet, you know, make no mistake, the vision of the people in the 50s, including in Indonesia, was that of a developmental state ran partially by managers and experts.
And that sort of also brings us to another central concept to your book, which is authoritarian modernization. And I think from your previous answer, it does seem that it's a global development and it's an ideology that's potentially appealing to many different states. So could you tell us a bit more about authoritarian modernization in particular, and how did it become a sort of theoretical framework for your book?
Well, obviously, the idea of modernization, especially today, is seen by many to be inherently authoritarian. Yet I really want to show in this book that Sukarno's effort, his so-called revolution, while resulting in the death of Indonesia's liberal democracy experiment in the 1950s, was one that was animated by what he saw as a form of democratic oversight against the looming threat of expert control. So in this sense, Sukarno had been adamant to stress the democratic nature of his revolution, as can be seen in its name, Guided Democracy, right? It was an effort to position the people in the process of planning and its implementation through institutional innovations in the National Planning Board, government-owned corporations, and so forth. In its implementation, it obviously created a lot of problems, including corruption and the reduction of efficiency, but the democratic nature of his project, as Sukarno sold it, was very clear. While he saw democracy not through a liberal lens, seeing liberalism as an extension of Western imperialism, it was nevertheless democratic in its conception. The implementation of a managerial state, the managerial ideology that was championed by the United States through their aid program, was inherently authoritarian as well. Sukarno understood this undemocratic nature of the new elite ideology of managerialism. Yet what is so interesting is that despite the machination of the Guided Democracy to achieve some sort of balance between development and popular representation, the end result would still be the formation of an authoritarian developmental state. Now the question is, did Sukarno fail? Or was this a normal result of an implementation of a developmentalist state despite the effort by Sukarno and others to institutionally encompass political oversight by the people, as Sukarno had wanted to, and yet inherently resulting in a form of authoritarian democratization? This is why the link between development and authoritarianism becomes a focal theoretical point of this research.
Right. And I think it is really interesting that you point out that Sukarno's conception of the state was democratic in its core, right? And your question about did Sukarno fail, and that reminds me of the debate between Herbert Feith and Harry J. Bender about the state of democracy in Indonesia, where Feith saw the advent of guided democracy as the decline of constitutional democracy, which in a way means Sukarno failed, and Bender kind of saw it as a reassertion of traditional Indonesian political systems. So I'm wondering, since in the introduction in your book, you rhetorically sort of ask, as Bender says, why would Indonesia be enthusiastic about democracy when it was never part of their cultural repertoire? Would it be right to say you are on the side of Bender in this debate?
Yeah, interesting question, Faiza. I would say I'm actually more along the lines of Herbert Feith in this regard. Bender's argument was that Indonesia's cultural memory of Javanese or traditional statehood, which lacked a liberal democratic component, made the possibility of creating a real liberal democracy impossible. Yet, you know, since the fall of Suharto, Indonesia has been quite a successful democratic state in implementing, you know, a raucous, chaotic democracy, but which at the end of the day is considered by many to still sort of work. My argument would be a bit similar to Faith in that the circumstances of the 1950s really was the reason for the demise of Indonesia's first experiment with democracy. In particular, I see the Cold War hegemonic imaginary of the managers as an important component in this regard, as a backdrop or vessel for change in many societies throughout the Third World. While many people blame this on American modernization theory, which is true to a large extent, I think it is also important to focus on the importance of local agency. The 1950s fixation on the managerial ideology provided the impetus, motivation, and model for changing democracy. But as we can see with Sukarno, it was a choice made by locals. Local agency was central. And the definition of the Indonesian managerial state on the one hand, and Sukarno's politician, military, and managerial model versus the new order, purely manager model, which was both realized and defined by local Indonesian elites on the ground. So, you know, while the process of making it local seemed to support Bender's thesis going back to traditional Javanese statehood, what I really want to provide is actually a more nuanced picture, which would combine both this international ideological support for managerialism and a pragmatic local approach that very well uses some cultural description of power and state-society relations. So I guess in a sense, my answer is that both sides really do matter, but the conditions, the global conditions and the local conditions of the 1950s and underlying ideology at the time really provided the impetus for the shift towards the authoritarian states of the new order. Because, you know, one thing which we cannot answer in the negative is, you know, we don't know why had liberal democracy continued in Indonesia in the 50s, it would have created a normal state as well, you know? So the fact that liberal democracy failed in the 50s, that's what's important to understand. Why did it fail? And in this case, I feel like the most pertinent answer to that has to lie within this context of the managerial ideology that was permeating the globe at the time.
And I want to pick up on your point about international support, I think, for this sort of managerial, the development of this managerial class. And we see that, I think, in the nations of the Global North and what is now the Global North and the Global South connecting through the circulation of technocrats. And that's more commonly associated, I think, with the New Order period. But could you tell us a bit more about how global powers are supporting or challenging political developments in Indonesia during this guided democracy, as well as maybe the liberal democracy period?
Yeah. Well, you know, the advent of technocracy in Indonesia and many other parts of the world was, well, especially in Indonesia's case, developed through international aid structure in the context of the Cold War. And so Soviet and communist aid mainly supported military procurement of weapons and engineering education. It was really the American aid in providing secondary and tertiary education in America and in Indonesia, which focused on social science, including education in business management and public administration. So there's definitely a strong Cold War component in allowing this generation to appear. Yet it must be emphasized that American aid did not inculcate Indonesian experts to be supporter of dictatorships. Such supports came in the form of a logical conclusion to the needs of state-led development. So in many ways, the ideological tool that was offered by managerialism was met with Indonesian ideas of pragmatism and the needs of the state, along with a new bureaucratic elite and their effort to regain control from non-state elements, including from the various political elites that have developed during Indonesia's nationalist movements up to independence. So I guess, you know, it's a mixture of American aid and the need of the state to implement a strong form of development. And this became the legitimacy for the new elite, one which they took with relish, but in which, again, in that sense, global power is a core component in understanding why they appear.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, this support from global powers also took a bit of a dark turn in the sense that you argue that the Indonesian state later became a kind of counter-insurgency state. Could you tell us a bit more about that? Why do you make this argument and how does a counter-insurgency state function?
When I started doing my research, it was focused on managers or on production of administration, public administration, business managers and so forth. What I found immediately was just the presence of the military managers within both public and business management in Indonesia during that time. In a way, both military and civilian managers and experts shared insights, the same insights that was important in understanding Indonesian state-society relations that were developed in the 50s. And really, that insight was the need to rein in what they considered to be a highly politicized society. Now, this is a central narrative in Indonesian New Order Indonesian history, that Indonesian society was chaotic and thus they failed to develop as a result of the politicization of society. If we read into the books of both military managers, especially those within the army officer schools and the various management magazines that were published in the 1950s, they often featured military leaders like the head of the Indonesian army, General Ahana Sution, or some of the commanders of the military command, and particularly the commander of the West Java Military Command, Ibrahim Aji, and oftentimes they point out the need to form population control. Within this vision, which are shared by Indonesian economists and experts as well, Indonesian society was seen as being infiltrated by enemies from communism, radical Islam, Western liberalism, and so forth. So this kind of doctrine defines the population as enemies, which require various avenues of control. This point to the idea of counterinsurgency as a central part of the managerial state, in which population would be redefined as potential threats for insurgencies. In this Cold War atmosphere, there was a belief amongst some in the army that the formation of a developmental state required the integration of the army within that state in order to allow for population control. And this, of course, happened by the mid-50s upwards, but especially during the guided democracy, where the army came into all various parts of society and state in Indonesia. And this idea was something shared by experts. So in this regard, Indonesia's developmental state and its managerial ideas and ideology very much incorporated ideas of counterinsurgency, in which they saw the population as a field for applying disciplinary actions to allow for control, which they saw as central to providing development for Indonesia.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies has the generous support of the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, connecting you with the Australian National University's wealth of expertise in the politics, languages, societies, and economics of Southeast Asia through research, teaching, events, and more. To get details, visit seasiainstitute.anu.edu.au. That's SE Asia Institute as one word.
Welcome back to the podcast. We are with Dr. Farah Bifake talking about authoritarian modernization in Indonesia's early independence period, published by Brill in 2020. And in the earlier part of this episode, we have talked about the concept of guided democracy revolution, how this was supported by aid during the Cold War, and the emergence of an Indonesian managerial state. Let's sort of build up on that, because as I understand from your book, the development of science also grew and was enabled by this sort of politics of authoritarian modernization during this period. Can you tell us more about this process, and also why you saw this modernization also as a process of re-traditionalization, which is a very counterintuitive observation?
Yeah. Well, I guess going back to our previous discussion, the way in which many Indonesian leaders, including Sukarno, but also Nasution and others, in defining a new relations between state and society is often based on traditional ideas, right? Just Javanese notions of citizens within a familial context. The familial ideology of the New Order State and its roots in continental legal ideas, which has been, expounded by David Bourchier, among others. Bourchier has shown that it has roots in adat ideas developed during the Dutch colonial period, thus pointing it to actually being partially Western, in particular Dutch or German origins. In this regard, I focus on the discourse of Indonesian elites. Regardless of its hybrid Western Indonesian roots, the idea of controlling Indonesian population through a new form of relationship between the state and society, or a familial one, was something that was voiced as a form of going back to tradition. So, yet importantly, this engagement with traditions, i.e. with sort of feudal traditions of society, in which people were under the behest of their leaders, were conjoined with modern ideas of managerialism, and they saw no problem in this context. Thus, the ideology of scientific managerialism was conjoined with the ideas of so-called traditional statehood rooted in Indonesian history. The idea of the role of Indonesian society, especially those on the masses, are discussed both in managerialist terms, but also in traditional Japanese terms. So in that sense, the root reason for this is because the endpoint is still the same, the creation of a strong state with various means of control for the population, which is the end goal of the idea. And, this just points out to the way in which such global ideologies are localized, whereby local agency, in particular, in this case, Indonesian leadership, which for the most part are or has their roots in Javanese aristocracy, played the most decisive role. And so they sort of conjoined ideas of Javanese aristocracy, which either developed, which is something which, as Benda has mentioned, is rooted much deeper in Javanese statehood, which, as Bourchier has shown, has, colonial roots as well, sort of adat ideology of the colonial period, but also present period, where the 50s, where it can be conjoined into these modern notions of managerialist ideology.
Is this specifically Javanese traditionalization, do you see, or is it also happening in other parts of Indonesia?
Well, I don't look at it my main focus is on reading the discourse that are produced by leaders, Indonesian leaders. And what's really interesting, of course, is that in a lot of ways, the kind of feudal notion, Javanese notions that are used to support the other managerialist claim, for the most part, they use Javanese ideas of statehood or citizenship, Kaula Gusti and so forth, right? So, and the idea of the sort of noblesse oblige ideas of the Javanese aristocracy placed in a different context. So in that sense, it's very much, from what I've read so far, there's a very strong Javanese roots to this discussion used by now so-called modern Indonesian managers. But, you know, they still use the, and they use very Javanese notions, Javanese philosophies, Javanese sayings, which became prevalent in the New Order period, right? But we see this in the 50s already by people who are supposedly westernized, you know, supposedly highly are Western managers.
Right, and there's a fascinating aspect of the discourse that I think has not been centralized much in the literature. I also want to kind of pick up on an earlier point that we talked about, that you mentioned briefly, I think, in the earlier segment, which is about the rise of a military elite during this period under study. And there were three chapters, I think, in your book that concern the formation of this elite. Could you also share with us some of your key findings about the position of the military elite during the liberal democracy and guided democracy period? And do you see in this period the beginnings of the oligarchy that the new order was most famous for?
Yeah. Well, you know, I look at the Indonesian military elites, as I've described them, as central to the creation of the developmental state through a couple of means. So on the one hand, from an institutional point of view, the military's role in, for instance, nationalizing Dutch-owned companies at the end of the 1950s, they really strengthened their position as a core component in the Indonesian managerial class. That's why if you go to the various management courses that appeared in the end of the 50s, it's always a collection of military and civilian managers running the companies that are, you know, now being taught these various management courses. On the other hand, the army itself, of course, developed its doctrine, which focused on the idea of what's now known as the Karya doctrine, or the military dual function role that was sort of the backbone of the new order military state, right? So the expansion of army positions into various sectors of Indonesian lives. This isn't the new order phenomenon. In fact, it's really started under guided democracy. In fact, if you look at like the number of governors, army governors of provinces during Sukarno's last year in power, in comparison to Suharto's early years of New Order period, there were more military governors under Sukarno than under Suharto. Now, I don't really focus on the oligarchy, which is really looking at the relationship between army and private sector, and which this period definitely, but you know, this period definitely formed the backbone for the relationship, which would later on create the New Order oligarchy, but. Definitely, at the doctrinal level, at the institutional level, at the expanding military role in companies in during the 50s, and the creation of new relationship with a lot of mostly, you know, for instance, Chinese Indonesian businessmen, we can see very much then that this, although it's not the focus of my research, that the oligarchy is very much rooted during this period.
Thank you for highlighting, I think a certain conflation in my question that conflates state-society relation with the sort of army-private sector connection. I think you're absolutely right that these are two different set of connections that perhaps should be examined separately. I think I want to also look at how you disrupt some of the well-established categories such as leftist, liberal, communist, and so on. So when you push back this idea that the template for the military elite was set in the 1950s, then the emergence of the kind of repression of the political left in the new order takes on a different significance. So could you tell us more about how in the last set of the book you add nuance to the history of how these categories, leftist, liberal, communist in particular, came to be applied to Indonesian politics? And how did they illustrate, as you argue, that the difference between the guided democracy and the new order lay not between capitalism and liberalism, and communism, but between a state-centered and a participative type of ideology. So tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, thank you. So, and yeah, my main argument really is on this level in that, you know, to understand this period in Indonesian history, we really need to require to rethink about the Cold War divide. Because, I mean, there certainly was a divide, in particular the divide between the politicians versus the experts. And this is something that's not unique to Indonesia, as we've seen. And this is of course, the discussion by Herbert Feith, right, about the division between the solidarity maker and the administrator. But you can see that in Pai's analysis of the Burmese leadership or elite, and also Schurman's analysis of the Chinese, communist Chinese leadership in the 50s as well in China. But what's really important is that it wasn't an ideological divide between the West and the East as commonly described, but between what Sukarno had in mind with his idea of democracy and a particular form of political participation. So Sukarno wanted to, in a way, save the politician in this new managerial mode of statehood versus a more state-centered one that required a more obedient form of relationship between state elites and society. So it is important not merely to define Sukarno's ideas as being to the left or on the east side, right? Because, for instance, Soviet aid to the Republic was mostly along the lines of military hardware, and the Soviet-developed relationship with the Indonesian army. They also provided lots of aids for industrial development and provided engineering education to some Indonesians. Thus, the Soviet was just as state-centered as the Americans. So in this regard, the division between capitalism versus communism might hinder our understanding of Indonesian history during this period instead of helping them, because the question really then becomes, what happens to efforts to create participative ideology, a participative type of ideology, which Sukarno tried to implement, and which in a way was expressed most succinctly in the 60s in Indonesia with the Communist Party, the Indonesian Communist Party, trying to enter into the state. Because what's interesting about Indonesian Communist Party, despite being, you know, it's the third largest communist party in the world, but it is not a controlling party, right? I mean, if you compare that to the Chinese Communist Party or the Soviet Communist Party, which controls the state, the Indonesian Communist Party is outside of the state. And this is where Sukarno's Guided Democracy Revolution tried to sort of open up society and thus open up ability by organizations like the communists to participate in the state. So it is in a way to implement both a managerialist state form, but also one that would increase participation, increase a kind of idea of democracy, which Sukarno had. And the destruction of the Communist Party in 1965, thus in a way is really, really can be looked at, of course, as a destruction of the left. But it can also be looked at within the context of the destruction of that participative type of ideology in comparison to the state-centered one, which was supported by the managers.
Exactly. And I find it really interesting, I think, as a Singaporean interested in Indonesian politics, that I can find a lot of parallels, I think, between what you're describing just now about the demise, so to speak, of a participative type of ideology, dating also back from to the 1950s and the 1960s. So I'm interested to know, and this is departing a little from your book, whether when we look regionally, do you think that Southeast Asian authoritarianism or authoritarians in Southeast Asia are learning from each other?
Yeah, I think they do, definitely, yeah. Because, you know, in particular, if you look at the New Order period, for instance, there are a lot of similarities between Suharto's New Order and the military regime of Myanmar under the SLO, the SLORC, the SLORC. And then, of course, going back, Sukarno's vision of statehood itself, which he always positioned as a vision against what he saw as Western imperialism, in which, in his mind, liberalism is very much part of Western imperialism. And, of course, in the later years of his rule, in which he envisioned an arc of non-Western forms of third world development model, you know, his Pyongyang, Beijing, Hanoi, Jakarta axis, which, of course, never went anywhere, but which was the latest of his foray into creating a different model for development in the third world, his so-called new emerging forces. So in a way, this arc of experimental, non-liberal, developmental state that was participatory and its demise towards a strong military state in the third world is shared by many other nations. it's interesting how much parallel there are. So it allowing some form of mimicry and learning from each other. Of course, the question which really is important is to understand why is this participatory democracy that Sukarno envisioned failed? Although, you know, and again, it really depends on the local conditions, because I would imagine it's very difficult to replicate Singaporean version of authoritarianism with Indonesia just merely by looking at how different the two countries are. But definitely, it's a transnational process. There's a lot of mimicry. There's a lot of borrowing, and this aspect is something which I think has potential to be developed in understanding why the Third World Project failed the way it did in the 60s, 70s upwards.
Definitely. And one of the legacies that we're leaving with in terms of the sort of authoritarian history is a kind of research environment in some ways. And I want to sort of move into your personal experiences in this direction. Did you find it difficult researching an authoritarian, a history of kind of authoritarian past? And what would your advice be to maybe junior scholars who are looking to do the same thing in Southeast Asia or Indonesia in particular?
Well, you know, my advice would probably be, from what I've really learned, but one thing which I haven't really developed much further is the potential of looking at it as a transnational or global processes, but one in which it is very much ensconced within local dynamics. So I suppose the better approach would be to conduct a comparative historical analysis, as is usually conducted by political scientists with a historical approach. And many books have been developed within this comparative approach, which, Linda Low and so forth. And these are very insightful. So, my book is not this type of political science approach, because I'm primarily an historian, and my focus has been mainly to develop a more nuanced understanding of Indonesian history during this interesting period. But obviously, I think we can sort of develop this further in a more comparative transnational approach, which I think has a lot of potential for saying something new on this topic.
Yes, and I think moving sort of transnationally is going to generate maybe 10 PhDs and dissertations, hopefully. So thank you for that tip. As you sort of refer to the literature that you used in your book, could you maybe share with us some of the interesting books that you found in your research, which you think could be underread or underrated, and you would like to recommend to the listeners at the New Books Network?
Yeah, well, and this is probably one of the most difficult questions, actually, because there's so many interesting stuff. I guess, I would really argue we should go back to reading the old classics. In particular, I would argue, rereading stuff like Herbert Feith's book on Indonesian in the 1950s, Indonesian political history in the 1950s, with a fresh perspective that we now know and have today, right? In doing so, we're able to sort of reread it in a different manner, because in a sense also these books were part of history. They're really historical sources, and because they shape in part how not only academics but how Indonesians elite view or engage with the subject matter at hand, with the state, with the society. I mean, obviously, in that level, a lot of modernization theory books that have been published, Michael Latham and so forth, who sort of criticized American modern modernization theory. That kind of work is interesting, and it would be included within, so we can then read these older texts more critically. So I guess maybe So going back to the classics and sort of re-engaging with them, that's really, obviously that's what you're going to have to do anyway, but I would stress on the sheer importance of that act, I guess.
That reminds me, I'm quite inspired to do that as well, because you've made quite a persuasive case for that. Before we end, could you tell us a bit more about your next research project?
Yeah, well, currently I'm writing a paper on the revolutionary period, and what I meant by that, of course, the Indonesian Revolution for Independence, 1945-1950. And I'm looking at the city of Yogyakarta, the capital city, the revolutionary capital of the Republic of Indonesia, at that time during the War for Independence between 1946 and 49, and is actually currently my place of residence. And in that research, I look at into the way the spaces of the city is used symbolically by the Republican elites at that time, including President Sukarno, but also by other parties, for instance, various political groups, to effectuate the Republic as a real thing. Because we have to remember that during this period, there was a war with the Dutch, and you know the state itself doesn't really exist. It had to sort of be conjured. And this happened, of course, during the wartime period. But you know, the earnestness in Indonesia to perform the idea of independence within the capital was something that really informed us of how the capital, the state itself, would eventually be affected in the post-colonial period. So I look at how exactly life was like there in the capital. Another aspect which I look is in particular are stuff like sports or the pop cultural life of the Republican elites in the capital. So what kind of music and plays and theaters were performed, and what themes did they explore during a period of duress under the threat of Dutch attack?
That sounds super fascinating. And I think sports, but in particular, is a new angle to which to think about the revolution. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that, just as a kind of taster for what's to come?
What really animated the idea of rereading the history of the revolution in the context of the revolutionary capital for me was really the idea of Judith Butler analyzing performativity in its relation with identity, how people perform their identity within the space. And so the idea of performing the nation was something that obviously had always been interesting to me, because during my bachelor's degree, my research was into looking at how Sukarno formed Jakarta's spaces in order to be performed as a Republican, but also as a global and non-imperialist capital. So the interest on performance, identity, and space was a feature that always interested me. There's one thing that can be tied to the book project, which I'm doing now, on the research on youth and sport during the revolution. So the idea of participation and how one crafts or control participation. This is something which I think Sukarno intuitively saw as central to state power. Sukarno, you know, he's a very interesting person. Sukarno's idea always had a very strong element of theatricality. He's an orator. He looks at the world as a stage. And this is something which continued strongly after independence. But really, including in the formation of the diverse array of new institutions in the name of development. So what I saw, one of the major interests I saw was how exactly did Sukarno saw Yogyakarta as a theater? How did he, not just Sukarno, but also other elements, youth elements, how did they sort of use Yogyakarta to sort of proclaim their legitimacy within the new republic? And it's interesting because and then you can see then that the developmentalist ideas that Sukarno envisioned later on during the 50s, these ideas already existed during the revolutionary period. But also the kind of participatory nature that Indonesian society would, be expressed within its politicized civil society, that existed as well during this period in which there was a major war between the Dutch and the Indonesian Republic. But, you know, why was this performance of the nation within that small, space of the capital, why was it so important? And, you know, why was it performance and in its enunciation so central to making it real to the Indonesian audience, but also to the audience outside of Indonesia? So it had to... The Republic really didn't have a place, but you know, it had to be performed so that people knew that it was there before Indonesia gained independence.
Yes, it sounds like really groundbreaking research, and I'm really excited about it. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you.
It has been a real delight to chat with you. Thank you. And thank you too to all listeners. You have been listening to New Books in Southeast Asia Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network discussing Farabi Fakih's authoritarian modernization in Indonesia's early independence period, the foundation of the new order state, 1950 to 1965, available and published by Brill in 2020. I hope you have enjoyed the conversation. Join us next time.